What's at stake in the election is not this or that policy. It's whether we even have democracy. The question is whether we even have America.
Ms. Anderson, thank you for joining me on the Dissents podcast.
It's a pleasure.
It seems like your home country, America, is in flames, Ms. Anderson. California is burning as a result of climate disaster.
Yeah.
The healthcare system and the social system are collapsing under the mismanagement of the Trump administration. And the country is run by a man who is, from the outside perspective, at least half clown and half fascist.
It's not even from an outside perspective. Many Americans share your perspective.
Yeah. Ms. Anderson, how would you describe the United States just before the 2020 presidential elections?
We're a deeply polarized country. A lot of this is a response to demographic panic on the part of white Christian America. They see their power waning. Whites will probably be a minority in the United States, maybe in 20 years or so. And that's creating a kind of reaction. We get enormous numbers of immigrants. Trump has tried to shut that down. And I really think that demographic panic lies at the root of our current political polarization and the fact that we have a clown in the White House. He is very effective in channeling the fears and resentments of his followers. He's not really about policy. He's a populist ruler whose deliverables to his people are fundamentally symbolic. He's promising to restore them to their former glory and to rain contempt and derision on all the groups that his followers fear and resent.
Yeah, we want to talk about that more in a minute, but first let me say a warm welcome to all our listeners out there. Our guest on this week's show is Elizabeth Anderson. She's teaching philosophy at the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
Ms. Anderson, we came actually together to talk about your book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. But actually, it's not that often that I get a renowned intellectual like you from the US, so I wanted to talk about with you a bit about Trump and also the upcoming election on 3rd of November.
Let's just jump in.
Yeah, this racism that you talked about in your beginning remarks, and we also have to add the agitation of Trump in favor of white America to it, I guess. They seem to be at the root of the civil unrest we see right now in many American cities, I think.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
In many cases, we see right-wing militias attacking Black Lives Matter protests. Some even see the United States at the brink of another civil war. What do you make of that situation, Ms. Anderson?
There are certainly radicalized groups who would like to see that happen, overwhelmingly on the right. Black Lives Matter is not fundamentally a violent movement. Sometimes you see opportunists go in there to engage in looting, but overwhelmingly, the Black Lives Matter protests have been peaceful. It's been the police who've been rioting against peaceful demonstrators. They've been extremely violent, but then you have these far right groups, militias, and so forth. And as you know, the rates of ownership of guns exceeds any other place, at least in the democratic world. I mean, we're just awash in guns, and many people fantasize about using them against perceived threats, and those people are welcomed by the police to do the work that the police maybe don't want to do for themselves. It's very violent and scary.
And how would you say is Donald Trump fueling racism and hatred in that situation?
Trump refuses to denounce far-right racist violence. You know, his first campaign was filled with racist agitation, as has been his entire administration. He's retweeted far-right racist tweets multiple times. He's refused to unify the country when there has been anti-Black and anti-Semitic violence. We're at an extremely dangerous moment. But of course, this is not unique in American history. From the beginning, the United States has embodied a contradiction, and you can see it even in some of our founding documents and in the life of Thomas Jefferson, early president of the United States, who simultaneously authored the Declaration of Independence, in which he declared a principle of human equality as self-evident, but he was a slave owner. Okay, so well, you know, that contradiction has defined the United States from the start. Is this a country that really recognizes the full equality of all human beings and welcomes people from every part of the world to its country as potential citizen? That's the history of America as a nation of immigrants. But opposed to that has always been another vision of America as for white people only, committed to using violence to keep down other groups, especially Blacks, also American Indians, indigenous peoples. Mm. The whole history of the United States is a conflict between those two visions. And periodically we see the white supremacist vision rise up in a pretty violent, dangerous way to defend its view of what America is.
A lot will come down, I guess, to the upcoming elections.
Correct.
Probably one of the most important elections in US history. What are your predictions for the race? What scenarios are we likely to face?
Okay, well, there's no question at all that Biden will easily win the popular vote by a larger margin than Hillary did 4 years ago. However, we don't have a democratic system for counting those votes. The president is elected through this obscure and ridiculous system known as the Electoral College, which overweights the votes of people from low population states, and most of those states are Republican. So Trump has an inherent advantage in the Electoral College, and there are battleground states, Florida, Pennsylvania being the two most pivotal ones. The vote there will probably determine the election. And it's very much an open question whether Biden or Trump will win those states. And the second main question is chaos at the polls. Because of the pandemic, many people are voting absentee. Far more Democrats than Republicans are voting by mail. And Trump is casting doubt on the legitimacy of mail ballots, falsely claiming that they're full of fraud. And I very much worry that he will create a scenario very much like the 2000 presidential election, where the recount was stopped in Florida and the Supreme Court permitted, in fact, basically issued an order that the recount stop, even though it probably would have delivered the victory to Gore. And I'm sure that Trump's lawyers will be doing exactly the same thing in the battleground states, trying to issue lawsuits to stop the counting of absentee ballots that are disproportionately Democratic and just refuse to count them. And that could swing the election his way.
Mm.
And whether those lawsuits succeed, I think depends on how much he has succeeded in packing the courts with judges who are extremely hostile to voting rights.
Right now, the election, you already mentioned it, is overshadowed by the corona pandemic. What do you think? Is Trump more likely to lose because of his crisis management, or is this effect exaggerated?
Oh, there's no question he's lost support because of his disastrous coronavirus response. In particular, his base is concentrated among older voters, but older voters, of course, are also more vulnerable than younger ones to serious consequences from COVID infection. So many of them actually are disaffected from Trump because of his gross mishandling of the pandemic response. And so I do think that that puts his reelection in jeopardy.
Yeah, we don't hope that he's getting reelected, but if he wins, what pops up into your mind if you think about the fact that he could be the president for another 4 years? And what would that mean for the United States and for the world?
Oh, it's the end of America.
Okay, that's a drastic description.
Now, look, Trump has already bent over backwards to destroy America's reputation worldwide and its capacity for leadership. And that decline will only accelerate with another 4 years of him in office. He's already taken a wrecking ball to most of the federal agencies. So we're facing a situation where we have these major problems we have to deal with, including the pandemic, climate change, the fires out west, which are a manifestation of climate change, even the census, even the post office. Basic government services are getting destroyed. It'll be very difficult for the United States to recover from such a catastrophic administration. We're definitely past peak America, I think.
Okay. Regarding the election, are you going to vote for Joe Biden or are you going to vote against Trump and just choosing the lesser evil?
Well, in policy terms, I'm not really much of a fan of Biden. However, I want to say the following in his favor. We're in a deeply polarized state right now with Democrats and Republicans hating each other. The levels of division and hatred are very strong in the United States. And if there's one thing to be said for Biden, his decided moderation and his empathetic persona, which I do think is genuine, The main message that he's sending is, I'm going to take care of everybody. I care about everybody. My duty is to represent Democrats and Republicans and independents and everybody in America. So I do think potentially because of his personal style and his emotional connections, he might actually help unify the country and tamp down the polarization. And if he could do that, then even if he doesn't deliver a lot on policy grounds, that would be a major advance for American democracy to calm everybody down and enable us to listen to each other rather than screaming at each other. That would be a kind of cultural achievement, even if it doesn't result in specific policy outcomes.
Actually, I hear from some people on the American left that they, even in the light of Donald Trump, they don't want to support Joe Biden because of his neoliberal politics. What do you think of that?
I am deeply critical of people like that. I think the stakes are higher. The question is whether we even have America. Here's the way I'm thinking about it. What's at stake in the election is not this or that policy. It's whether we even have democracy. A prerequisite to democracy is people not thinking that they're under existential threat if the other side wins power. And an ability to listen and talk to each other, share our experiences. Those are just prerequisites to democratic policymaking. That people can hear each other, and that requires that people calm down and seriously listen. And if Biden could do that, that would be an essential starting point to rebuilding a tattered democracy. Right. We got to just rescue the country and then we can talk about policies.
By the way, Ms. Anderson, when you look at the Democratic Party, which is kind of divided between two poles, on the one side, the moderate centrists like Joe Biden, and on the other side, the progressives in the Bernie Sanders camp, which direction do you think is the party heading like in the future?
Well, I do think that we're seeing a major generational shift. So Biden is representing older Democrats. The youth are rising and they're going to inherit this country. There's no question they're well to the left of the older generations. I actually have a sense that we're going to have a replay of the 1960s with tremendous degrees of youth activism, this time centered around climate change and the economic crises that are linked to it. This country's definitely moving to the left. The question is whether we can do it quick enough to save the earth.
So we might see like a Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez like in 2024, right? Like running like kind of a Bernie platform, I guess.
Yeah.
Is that your hope for the progressive movement in the United States, or what do you wish for?
I do think the most urgent issue is climate change. I mean, all of humanity is under severe threat for climate change. We need drastic action on that. I'm a strong supporter of the Green New Deal, which also calls for linking action on climate change to fundamental economic reforms, where we start paying attention to workers, ordinary people, and don't just pile billions on billionaires.
What's the position of Biden on the Green New Deal, by the way? At least he acknowledges climate disaster in contrast to Donald Trump.
He does. So his messaging has been very cautious because even the word climate change is a highly polarizing term in American politics. So instead of talking about climate change, Biden's talking about infrastructure. Right. We got to change our infrastructure, including our energy infrastructure, and we're going to generate lots of good jobs that way. I think it's shrewd as a policy message. Jobs are always very popular across the board. Everybody needs jobs. They need good jobs. So it's a great campaign message for Biden. He is skirting around the underlying reasons why we need to change our infrastructure. But bottom line, I just want the infrastructure to go green. And whether you call it green or not is a separate issue. Whatever wins. And of course, you have to realize that even though the United States is an unbelievably wealthy country, workers are far worse off in the United States than in peer countries in Europe. It's just shocking the levels of precarity that American workers suffer from and the lack of basic rights that are taken for granted by workers in Europe. You know, workers are not guaranteed any paid vacation at all. Mm. None. There's no 0 days of paid vacation. Okay. Half of all American workers through their employment contract will get paid vacation. But then if you look at whether they take all the days they're entitled to, most of them don't, because they're afraid that if they actually used all of their contractual entitlements, that they would be fired or they would lose a promotion because they don't show single-minded dedication to their job. So what we have is a society that's profoundly lacking in leisure and leading to overwhelming stress on the part of overworked workers. It's a very dysfunctional system, but that's just one example of where workers don't have rights.
All right. And that was the perfect transition, Ms. Anderson, to talk about your book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It.
Yeah.
In this book, you write about the issues of workers' rights and workplace democracy. It's not new. The US version was published 2 years ago, but I just recently had the privilege to read it in the German translation, Private Regierung. Let me begin by asking, Ms. Anderson, why might it be important in your eyes to talk about workers' rights and workplace democracy while there's a man in the White House who's actually dismantling democracy in its political sphere?
Well, if you look at how democracy gets built institutionally, the labor movement has always been a very important locus of democracy building. And in particular, in mobilizing ordinary workers, enabling them to educate themselves about the political issues of the day. If I were to trace some of the causes of the current crisis of democracy in the United States, certainly one of them would be the decline of labor unions in the United States. Labor unions used to be a vital source of voter education for ordinary workers, and they were also a centerpiece of anti-racist activism because many unions early on recognized that they would be destroyed if they were not racially inclusive. If they were all white unions, then the businesses would hire Blacks, immigrants, Latinos as strike breakers. And those people would say, well, why should we be in solidarity with you if you're not in solidarity with us? And the destruction of labor unions in the United States has been central both to widening inequality, economically speaking, and to the decline of democracy, because at root, our populist politics are really being driven by widening inequality in society. Behind every populist, you've got plutocrats, and whatever Trump says in a populist, you know, vein, what his actual political practice is deeply plutocratic. Tax cuts for the rich, deregulation for businesses, disregard for the interests of workers. And that kind of politics can succeed because unions have, for the most part, especially in the private sector, been destroyed in the United States. So workers don't have a voice.
But we have to see that it's not only like the right who did that, but also the party who usually calls itself center-left. So the Democratic Party in the past turned away or turned their back on workers and turned towards Wall Street, right?
Right. I do think that's true that the Democrats bought into a neoliberal agenda. But I also want to point out that that's an international phenomenon as well. You know, social Democrats in Germany went neoliberal and kind of abandoned a lot of worker interests. And no wonder they're getting killed in the polls.
Yeah, but it seems like it's not enough to talk only about restoring decency, as it sometimes comes from the Biden campaign, but also talk about like fundamental issues like workers' rights and stuff like that. And
yes.
But let's talk about your book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives. When we think about ruling, we normally tend to think about government. And this is something that the state does, right?
Yeah.
So why do you think that employers rule over our lives?
Most people spend a very large chunk of their adult lives at work. And within the workplace, there's an organization that's typically hierarchical, with managers giving orders to ordinary workers and managers reporting up a hierarchical chain to the CEO or the head of the firm. So we have a hierarchy, we have orders, and those orders are issued on pain of punishments such as firing or demotion. Wherever you have orders being issued to people on pain of sanction, you have government, just by definition. We have an authority structure here where some people have to obey what the orders other people give them. That's government. So I think it's high time that we think more politically about what's happening inside the firm and don't think that politics is only about what happens in elections or with the state. Mm.
Sometimes you even describe the workplace as a dictatorship, as the tyranny of the boss. Isn't it a bit far-fetched to compare the workplace to states like Belarus or China? Or what arguments in favor do you have for this comparison?
Well, it is true that bosses don't have the power to imprison their workers, not on their own authority at any rate. But there's still a lot of awful stuff that they could do to their workers. In the United States, bosses are free to bully workers and make their lives miserable. So it can certainly feel like a dictatorship if you're in a circumstance like that, in a workplace like that. And in principle, workers really don't have any effective protections against that unless they're represented by a labor union, which is rare in the United States these days.
It's getting also rarer in Germany.
Yes. My understanding in Germany, though, is that you don't have to be a member of a labor union in order to be represented by it.
Yeah.
A greater percentage of workers actually are covered by collective bargaining agreements. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it's right. But the representation is going down anyway because also of effects like the digitalization and the gig economy, for example.
Yes. And the rise of temporary contracts.
Yeah, exactly. It's declining.
Yeah.
But still, of course, the situation is much different to the US where you have like this hire and fire policy, as I understand it.
Yes. In the United States context, the default rule of employment is employment at will, which means that the employer can hire and fire for any or no reason at all.
Mm.
There are only a few reasons that are accepted in the law. You're not allowed to discriminate on grounds of race, gender, sexual orientation, but there's only a handful of prohibited grounds for hiring and firing people. Everything else is permitted, including just arbitrary likes and dislikes. So just the right to quit doesn't really mean that the internal organization or governance of the firm is no longer a dictatorship. It still is.
You're right that at work, we are willing to accept things that state authorities never would get away with. What do you mean by that?
The government of the workplace regulates people's motions, their talk, far more minutely than states do, even more minutely than most totalitarian states, right? I mean, your actual physical motions could be tightly regulated if you're on an assembly line. Your words are surveilled and regulated if, say, you are a customer service representative and you're talking to a customer. Everything is tightly monitored because you're really there to deliver goods and services for the firm. So your purposes are regulated much more tightly than if you're just out and about in civil society where the state, you know, issues traffic regulations and so forth, but doesn't tell you precisely what goals you have to be pursuing.
If we buy into your argument, when workplaces are more or less authoritarian private governments, so why is there so little talk about it and only in a small podcast like this? And why are not in like in big TV shows talking about this issue day in, day out?
Well, I do have a story about this in the American context, and that has to do with the American dream of universal self-employment. This was a dream that continues, but it has powered the American imagination of what a successful life will be, to ultimately not have any boss at all. And that vision was embedded in the original free market ideology that was promulgated before the Industrial Revolution came about. When in fact you did have high rates of self-employment, most people were farmers, and their ultimate aspiration was to own their own farm and be their own boss that way. And in fact, land ownership in the United States was incredibly widely dispersed compared to Europe. If you go back to, say, the time of the American Revolution in the late 18th century, it was actually quite easy for a white person to acquire land and own and operate their own farm. Mm. Abraham Lincoln, who's best known as being the wartime president during the American Civil War, advanced a party platform in the 1860 presidential election, which really had two planks. One was anti-slavery, but his second party plank was to give away lots of free land out west into small plots that individuals could farm just with their families. It was really a vision of universal self-employment, and there were some speeches that Lincoln made that sound practically like Marx. He said, labor is always superior to capital because capital depends entirely on labor. Hmm. It's almost like Marx saying capital is nothing but dead accumulated labor. Well, that was what Lincoln thought too. So workers should be the ones who are honored in society and should have freedom. But if you think that truly free markets are going to deliver freedom and autonomy to every individual on the basis of universal self-employment, then you're going to be very pro-free market, as Lincoln was, and think that's going to solve all your problems. If you don't think that the employment relation is going to be significant in people's lives, other than as a stepping stone to self-employment, and that's precisely how Lincoln talked about it. And if you're thinking of it this way, then you think, well, it doesn't really matter so much because it's you only do it for a few years. And then you have perfect freedom and autonomy in your own enterprise. And so that's why Americans don't really think that hard about the employment relationship and how awful it is for so many workers in the United States, because they're still chasing this dream of self-employment long after it was destroyed as a viable option for the vast majority of workers. People are still chasing that dream today.
And the ironic thing is, I guess, that today the dream of self-employment and being free of a boss kicks a lot of people in the ass, right? So when you look at the workers of the gig economy,
correct,
their lives are so precarious, even though they don't have a boss.
There is a lot of fraud packed into the idea that gig workers aren't employees. So if you look, say, at an Uber driver, they actually have to follow all kinds of minute regulations from Uber. Mm. I think that this is a employment relation that's disguised as a relationship with an independent contractor. And in fact, the misclassification of employees as independent contractors is absolutely pervasive in the United States. So for instance, delivery people whose exclusive employment is with a single firm, say an Amazon delivery driver, they're often misclassified as independent contractors when in fact all of their business is with one company. They wear a company uniform and a truck that's painted with a company logo. Mm. And the reason for calling them independent contractors is that then the employer isn't responsible for providing things like health insurance and benefits, retirement benefits, or what have you. And that's why people are being put out on the gig economy, is that then it enables employers to shed all kinds of costs, payroll costs associated with formal employment.
And what I can see here, at least in the case of the German labor market and self-employed people, a lot of them actually want to become employees.
Yeah.
So it seems that they prefer like the hierarchy of a company and maybe a shitty boss. They prefer that to the economic uncertainty that they face when they are self-employed. So what do you make of that, that some people wish for being in a hierarchical situation?
Yeah. So, I mean... Right. So there's several things. I mean, one is you don't want to have a precarious existence. Hmm. But another thing is that there are other ancillary benefits of being a regular employee at a workplace that aren't linked to hierarchy, but it's just a place for sociability outside the family, right? People like to go to the office because then they can meet other people and have forms of sociability that otherwise wouldn't be available to them. But the other thing I want to point out is that hierarchy as such doesn't have to be oppressive and dictatorial. The question is, I mean, any large-scale organization is going to involve some kind of organizational hierarchy, because it's the only way a large-scale organization can function effectively. You can't have participatory democracy on every decision a big organization makes. It would never be able to make decisions. And so hierarchy as such is indispensable for large organizations. The question is whether that hierarchy is accountable to the people who are governed under it. And that requires that those who are governed have some voice in management. And that's why in my book, I think that the German experiments with co-determination are highly valuable for thinking about a possible better future for American workers who currently overwhelmingly have no voice whatsoever in management.
I guess some leftists or progressive here in Germany would say, okay, that's all fine and good, but we should strive for something more like workplace democracy or companies owned by workers. So what follows from your analysis of workplace hierarchies, and what kind of interesting proposals do you see there?
Yeah, look, workplace democracy, worker ownership is great if you can get it. Thomas Piketty, in his latest book, Capital and Ideology, argues that one of the flaws of German social democracy and the other center-left parties in Europe is that they weren't aggressive enough in expanding worker representation in firms. So he argues for a much more aggressive mode of empowering workers and increasing their voice in the governance of firms. Yeah, I do think that we have to make major experiments in joint management between workers and representatives of capital within the firm. I think that's a more feasible path forward than pressing for full worker ownership of enterprises. You know, it's great if you can get those, but I don't think it's feasible in a lot of places. There's radical variation in how dedicated workers are to a specific workplace as a place where they want to make a career. Typically, entrepreneurs who found businesses, well, they really care about the survival and success of the business. But a lot of workers don't want to devote that kind of energy. So I'm not averse to the idea that the founder of a small business is entitled to a greater voice than any single worker might have. But we do have to really think carefully about workers, empowering workers, even if they're not represented by a labor union, to have a voice in management. And that's really where I think the main innovation should go. And we need to be more imaginative. The experiments that have taken place in German co-determination, I think they form a basis for learning and building on that model. But I think we should experiment with more variations along the lines that Thomas Piketty has proposed.
I wonder, Ms. Anderson, if you ever talked about your ideas and your description of the company as a dictatorship, if you ever talked about these ideas with people like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, not people at that level of exaltation, but I do actually talk to business people and people in business schools about these ideas. And I'm even a member of an organization called the Society for Progress that's trying to persuade capitalists to
give up their property.
Well, basically, to rethink what they're doing and to realize that profit maximization is not really a sensible idea. And in fact, I just gave a podcast on Nick Hanauer's show called Pitchfork Economics. And Hanauer's an interesting guy because he's a plutocrat who realized that the direction in which capitalism is going is highly destructive. So Hanauer is a serial tech entrepreneur. He may well have billions. I'm not sure how wealthy he is, but he's immensely wealthy. He finally realized, you know, all of this wealth is getting concentrated in the top 1%. And what does that mean for everybody else, right? Everybody else is getting left out. And he wrote a famous column a few years ago called "The Pitchforks Are Coming for Us Plutocrats." It was basically a message he's delivering to fellow rich people, billionaires, that if they keep on you know, acquiring all the wealth for themselves, there's going to be a revolution. Better rethink capitalism.
Kind of reminds me of Warren Buffett, right? Who said there is class war and guess who's winning?
Yes, exactly. And Hanover says the same thing. And now he's got a podcast called Pitchfork Economics in which he interviews a lot of people, right? About, okay, how can we change the economy before it leads to ruin?
Yeah.
So I do think that some of these ideas are diffusing. And of course, the current populist revolt that we see in the United States is partially, and not only in the United States, in many countries, is partially propelled by the rising inequality and anxieties that attend that, especially on the part of the white working classes, whose prospects really have declined precipitously from where they were in the immediate post-war era.
Regarding the issue of inequality and capitalist disaster, I wondered what you make of the idea of a universal basic income, because that idea seems to be passed around quite frequently right now.
Yeah.
And it promises kind of economic safety on the one hand, but also a greater level of self-determination and autonomy from companies or from bosses, you know? So when you look at your work, is there a connection? And what do you make of this idea?
Well, I think it all depends on how that might be implemented. Everything lies in the details.
Hmm.
I do think that a universal basic income could do a lot to rescue people from precarity. But we shouldn't expect that it can do a lot more than that. And the reason is that for the vast middle classes who expectations for standard of living that's well above whatever a universal basic income could deliver for them, the idea that this could like empower you to like quit work and go off on your own isn't really credible, because these people have mortgages to pay. People can't do that on any feasible universal basic income, right? It would be well below a standard middle class income and any feasible rendition. So I think while it could help, I wouldn't want to see it substitute for a rich array of publicly provided goods. In the United States, we're still haven't achieved universal healthcare access.
Hmm.
So if I were going to put my priorities, I would want to make sure that a richer menu of publicly provided goods was available to people, things like healthcare and decent education, since so many of our schools are failing, than to put all of our or put the bulk of our resources into a universal basic income. Whatever it would be, it could only be one component among an array of public policy measures needed to liberate workers.
Yeah.
And in the hands of a lot of libertarian thinkers who like the UBI, they're thinking, oh yeah, and then we can like eliminate the rest of the welfare state and just hand out cash. Well, there's just a lot of publicly provided goods that are indispensable. And mass transport would be another one of those goods, especially if we want to go green. The only place where that's going to happen is through public provision.
Ms. Anderson, regarding your work on the workplace and hierarchies, I wondered, are you also speaking from your own experience, because you're an academic and I guess you work fairly self-determined and free, but was there at any moment in your life like something where you were in a company and so do you speak from experience, or how do you gather your evidence?
Oh yeah, so earlier in my life, I was a college student and made some money over the summer working at a bank.
Hmm.
And I was a bookkeeper at a bank. Obviously, I mean, this is relatively comfortable conditions. There's nothing dangerous about working in a bank.
Unless there's a robbery, right?
Yeah. Well, of course, we weren't the ones with the cash. We were just handling the checks. We weren't tellers. But still, I was working there in an era where they were moving from an open office to cubicalization of office workers. And our manager just imposed this on us, even though it actually made the work less efficient, but it also suppressed the kind of easygoing banter that the workers had among ourselves.
Mm.
You know, we'd be running a conversation and telling jokes and stories and stuff while we're bouncing checks. And of course, with the cubicalization, it kind of suppressed some of that easy interchange, since we couldn't see each other and it was just more difficult to get things done. And we deeply resented the idea that this new office system was imposed upon us without any consultation whatsoever. And there was just seething resentment against our boss for having done this to us. So it's just a minor example, but it gave me a kind of insight into how far, you know, things could go, even in a relatively comfortable office job. And it was easy to see how things could get much more micromanaged than we were actually subjected to. Mm. And indeed, today, with the surveillance technology that's available to managers, practically nothing workers do isn't under scrutiny and control. So I do think that freedom in the workplace, even in the office, has been declining due to the untrammeled power that employers have and the technologies they have available to micromanage every movement and every word that workers utter.
Yeah. And I think in my case, the boss-employee relationship and what comes with it is kind of internalized, at least as a podcast host, my own boss and my own worker.
Well, you know, that feeds into my next book. I'm writing a history of the Protestant work ethic. You know, Americans have a very deeply embedded work ethic, and it all came from our Puritan origins. It's religiously driven. Europeans tend to be more secular, but I argue in my book that the work ethic did become secularized over time and informed people's attitudes and orientation, but also the history of political economy is just drenched in the work ethic.
Ms. Anderson, when you look into like 2021, like next year, what do you think and what kind of a world will you wake up?
Well, you know, everything depends on who wins the presidential election. Mm. If Biden wins, I do think that he can take some strides in finding for the United States a decent place in international relations. If Trump wins, it's just decline from here on out, probably on an unstoppable runaway train. And that would be bad, not just for the United States, but for the world because of the urgency of the climate crisis. If the United States doesn't take leadership on this, both in its domestic policy and in urging other countries to move ahead, I don't even see a decent future for the globe.
Ms. Anderson, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you.